we're not thinking about how we do this and do this well. And so look at the things that are opened up. We didn't ask, you know, and it's like, we don't care about teachers. Do we care about grocery store workers, right? Who haven't been able to go home? You know what I mean? Like, do we care about, you know, healthcare workers? Like, on and on and on. Education is extremely important.
That's Jeanette Powell. She's the parent of a child in a Los Angeles public school and a teacher in a non-LAUSD school. Governor Gavin Newsom sparked a big conversation yesterday when he suggested that in-person instruction in public schools could resume if teachers are prioritized when it comes to getting vaccinated.
And I believe we can safely reopen public schools to in-person instruction with the appropriate level of safety and support and accountability in terms of enforcing the rules of the road.
As California goes, so goes the nation. That's the cliche, but there's some truth in that right now, especially when it comes to getting students back in the classrooms. President Biden says he wants to reopen the country's schools during his first 100 days in office, at least K through 8 schools. But California and its teachers' unions could be one of the biggest hurdles in pulling that off. We're going to talk about that now with Mackenzie Mays. She covers education in California for Politico. Hi.
Hey.
Well, that wasn't the first time that the governor talked about reopening schools and expressed, I believe, some frustration. He did that in what he thought was a private video call with a group of superintendents and said, quote, if we wait for the perfect, we might as well pack it up and just be honest with folks that we're not going to open for in-person instruction this school year. You reported on that and described him as losing his cool in that conversation. So what is the governor's frustration?
Yeah, so the governor has for a long time expressed these concerns about learning loss and about our achievement gaps widening because schools have been closed for so long. The majority of California schools have been closed for almost a year now. And I think he's getting increasingly worried about that because now we sort of have this perfect cocktail of bad timing, right? We've waited long enough to where we saw another surge, which concerns teachers, and now the vaccines are so close, but at the same time, so far away, right? So now unions mm-hmm. are saying we won't go back into schools until we can get that vaccine in our arms. And it is really hard to say when that can happen.
And are they saying there's no way for any wiggle room there, like some of the teachers being vaccinated, or does it have to be everybody or nothing?
Yeah, so the teachers unions came together, CTA came out last night, actually, and proposed their own plan as sort of a response to the governor's proposal to get schools open. And they make it clear that vaccines are required. They do say, you know, if schools are already open right now, which there are a few schools open in California, if teachers are there in person, they should be first to get them. But that we should not be opening schools unless every single not just teacher, but adult employee staff get the vaccine.
Although the CDC has said that schools can safely reopen without everyone being vaccinated.
Yes, the CDC said that yesterday. And that's where you're hearing Newsom agree with that. You know, he's saying, let's listen to President Biden. Let's listen to the CDC. And what they're saying is if you mask correctly, if you socially distance 6 feet, if you do all of these things, which California schools already have in their plans to reopen, if you do those things, you don't need teacher vaccines. Teachers are saying, you know, they still don't feel safe. And they are prioritized in California. They are in the current tier, but counties are in charge. And there are other people that are in this tier. There are people 65 and older who are most likely to die from the virus who are in that same line. And so a lot of counties, including in LA, are prioritizing these 65 and older residents over teachers in a lot of cases.
Right. And so what has President Biden proposed to try to speed up that and to try to get more teachers vaccinated?
Yeah, so it's interesting. His plan to reopen schools during his first 100 days in office doesn't really focus on vaccines, but it's clear now and as of today that it's going to have to. So his plan is pretty similar to what Newsom has proposed, to what schools on their own have proposed in California, you know, widespread regular testing of students and staff, contact tracing, ventilation upgrades, all those things. But it seems like even if we have all of that in California right now, that's not enough. We need vaccines. And so there's a lot of hope in the Biden administration that getting bigger access, increasing the supply to all states, will then trickle down to teachers and then open the schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things the governor has talked about, and he talked about this yesterday in Oakland, is getting younger kids back in school, because they're suffering more because they can't really get as much benefit from online learning. This is what he said.
The younger kids are not getting the benefits of distance learning that the older kids are. And I'm very concerned about the equity lens in terms of this conversation, because so many private schools are open.
So he has a plan to get public elementary schools open quickly. That was not met with much enthusiasm on the part of some superintendents, including the LA superintendent. Can you talk about that and what's happening with that?
Yeah, so what's interesting is he's been trying to allow a pathway for elementary schools to open for a long time. You know, months ago, he introduced this waiver process. And so some elementary schools, if they chose to and wanted to reopen, could and have been open. But a lot of the schools that jumped on that were private schools. And you can hear that in his frustration yesterday. And some people might say it's because they don't have unions, or because they're much smaller and they're not part of this broader district to sort of deal with. So his latest plan would give grants to elementary schools willing to reopen in person. So you can use this money however you want, as long as it's not in distance learning. It's a way for him to sort of put his money where his mouth is and say, okay, do this. But there are rules, you know, and big urban districts like LA say, we can't even qualify for this. You know, it doesn't benefit certain districts, is their argument. And so they think it's pretty unfair to offer money to districts who they say, you know, they can't qualify for reasons beyond their control because their community and county case rates are so high.
Right. So it sounds like it really does come down to the local public health department getting enough vaccines and deciding to bump teachers up to the head of the line. Right.
And we haven't seen any sign that teachers could get further bumped up. And, you know, Newsom gets pressed on this a lot, and he will say repeatedly, teachers are eligible. He's basically saying, I've done everything I can by putting them in this current tier, but he's not going to go into a county and ask them to move a teacher in front of someone who's elderly. You know, he said some counties mm-hmm. have prioritized farm workers. It's up to counties to decide who needs it first. And it sounds like he's not going to intervene. But if the supply changes, I think that could really make an impact.
He's also facing a recall, possible recall, and slipping poll numbers. So, and the teachers unions are politically very powerful and support him, or they have. So is he also keeping an eye on that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, CTA, the California Teachers Association, is incredibly powerful. And Newsom and unions have long been allies, but this school reopening issue has pitted, you know, California Democrats, including Newsom now, against unions over this very specific issue. And I think this candid video of Newsom last week with superintendents, it obviously heightened those tensions with unions, but we saw a lot of praise from frustrated parents who saw Newsom, got a glimpse of him maybe as a father of young children, more so than as the governor of California. And so while it hurt him in the union's view, I think we can all agree, he did get some support out of it from people. You know, there were tweets saying this was the first time they felt like he wasn't an empty suit. You know, it did sort of move people in a positive way. But at the same time, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was not a good look from the union's point of view.
Mackenzie, thank you.
Thank you.
Mackenzie Mays, she covers education in California for Politico. Well, let's look at the school reopening debate here in Los Angeles. LAUSD and the union, UTLA, both say schools can't reopen until teachers are vaccinated. As we spoke of earlier with Mackenzie, the CDC disagrees, and they say they can safely. Also, a group of local pediatricians disagrees. In a press release yesterday, the regional Southern California chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics says schools should open immediately. They say the harm of keeping kids at home longer outweighs the risks. Let's talk about this now. We have two guests. Dr. Alice Kuo is chief of medicine pediatrics at UCLA and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Welcome to you, Dr. Kuo.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us is LAUSD board member Jackie Goldberg. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. How are you doing, Michelle?
Madeline. Jackie, what timeline is the district looking at for getting kids back in school? Is it possible at all that they will be back in the classroom this semester?
Sure, it's possible. It says if the infection rate continues to go down, right now it's at 11%, which is, we were told in November that when we were at 8% that that was too high to go back. But now we're at 11%, we're told it's okay to go back. He tells CTA the day before he goes to the administrators' hearing that we're not going to force anybody to go back until everybody's vaccinated that will be working with kids. And then the next day he says something different. You know, this is what we've been whiplashed. Every time we feel ready to do something, we get told that the standards have changed. And that's really part of the problem. Also, we're looking at data from folks who are not actually looking at the data in Los Angeles, including, I'm sorry to say, the pediatricians. We're still getting 6,000-7,000 cases a day. We're still getting an infection rate of 11%. We had 205 deaths yesterday and 224 the day before yesterday. We will not put people at risk. Now, everybody says, oh, it's okay. Kids don't spread it. And they, you know, well, I got news for you. We've been the only district in California that is doing regular testing of children and adults in our district. And the highest rate of infection has been in the children, about a 30% infection rate of those we've tested, where there's only been a 10% infection rate in the adults. Do we want to go back to school? Yes. Are we ready? Yes. Are the teachers' union holding this up? No. There are no bargaining units holding up our going back. We are not going back because the board and the superintendent have decided that science will be the issue, and that as long as we have such an outrageously high infection rate in our communities, particularly our communities of color, where of all the children who have had serious illness and death, 78% of the children who died are kids of color. We take that very seriously.
Yeah, I understand that. Let's get some response now to a lot of that data from Dr. Kuo. So what do you say to that? That it's just what Jackie was saying, that it's just too dangerous right now. The infection rate is too high, especially among kids, to open schools immediately.
Right. I think that there's some different interpretations of the data that's happening here. So when we look at the number of students that have actually returned to school campuses in LA County, it's about 90,000. Of course, none of those are in LAUSD, but we have 87 other school districts in the county of Los Angeles, in addition to the independent and religious schools. So 90,000 students through either the waiver process or their high needs are back on campuses, and 10,000 are additional adults are on campuses, many of whom are actually in LAUSD. And in the 3.5 months that this, that the students and adults were on school campuses, there were only 385 cases. So you're thinking 100,000 people, 385 cases over 3.5 months, and 80 to 90% of those cases were in adult staff, teachers or staff. So the infection rate that is being quoted is, yes, general for the county, but that is called community transmission. So there's no denying that community transmission is high in Los Angeles County because we have 10 million people. And despite repeated, requests from the Department of Public Health for people to stay home, it's difficult. And people are interacting with each other and people going to the supermarket and so on and so forth. So those data that were just reported are community transmission rates, but not the data that's happening on school campuses. And that's the key, because in the community, we can't regulate, we can't make people quarantine, we can't make people symptom check when they enter a supermarket. However, we do that on school campuses. And so with appropriate infection control practices, the must-haves, this universal masking, social distancing, hand hygiene, frequent wipe down of high-touch areas, and symptom screening, schools are actually one of the best sectors in LA County to be able to identify and isolate cases and prevent outbreaks, as compared to other industries such as food industries and, you know, retail. I mean, those numbers are mm-hmm. high, but yeah. not schools. And so I would say the infection control practices are the must-haves. Anything else is a nice-to-have.
And Jackie, the what Alice is saying is backed up by some studies that the CDC has relied on when it recommended that schools reopen even without mass vaccination of teachers. So what about what she just said, especially with younger kids, where science has shown that there is less transmission by younger kids and they are less apt to get ill?
Yes, well, they are, but I would like you to have her name the school districts that opened. They are almost all in affluent areas with a very low percentage of kids of color. That's who they are. That's who opened. You know, everybody says, oh, go ahead and open up. We don't care if more kids of color get sick and die or take it home to their multi-generational families and make them sick and die. We don't care if the bus driver who is making not a terrific high salary gets sick taking the children because the children are not symptomatic. You know, I don't understand this. We have vaccines. Why in the world, if we want schools to open, aren't personnel that interact with students on the top of the list right now? Really? That's the problem.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone in this debate would love that to happen.
On the top of the list, and Long Beach is getting their people vaccinated. If we can get the County of Los Angeles Public Health Department to put teachers and school personnel that interact with children on the top of the list, we could reopen.
So is your argument more with the L.A. Department of Public Health that they are not prioritizing teachers?
Well, and it's also with everybody, you know, because every single week we get a different notion of what it takes to reopen. We're told that we're purple, we can't open. Then we're told, well, yes, actually you can open, but you have to have 25 or fewer cases per 100,000. Well, we don't have that. We have four times that amount. So that's not. So then they change the standard, because if we can't meet the standard, they change the standard. That's not science. That's politics. Science is when we get people who are vaccinated in interacting with our children, we can reopen. We have no problems. UTLA and all of our bargaining units are working daily on working out the problems. And everybody says, well, what are the problems? Okay, let me give you a problem that we're trying to work out. You got six classes with your middle school kids. Does the teacher move or do the students move? Which is safer? We're not sure yet. Do you move them in one direction? Do you move them at different times during the different day? Do you need a different bell schedule for each school? Do you need to have a decision as to whether the teacher who is teaching both to the online kids and to the kids that are in the classroom, or both? And if they're doing both, how do they interact with the kids who are online? These are the issues we're discussing. We're not discussing whether they want to go back to work. Everybody wants to go back to meeting with kids.
And Dr. Kuo, we just have a few seconds left, but I wonder if you could just quickly summarize, you know, the effects that you're seeing in kids not being in school.
So obviously we've been saying that, you know, the impact on children has been detrimental the longer they stay away from school. But I will say to sort of clarify some of the points made earlier, LA County Department of Public Health has prioritized teachers. They are vaccinating the early care and education teachers. So preschool teachers have been working throughout this pandemic in person the entire time. And again, we have had hundreds of thousands of children, young children, in preschools, in classrooms, in person, without major outbreaks. I mean, really, when you look at the proportion of students and teachers who have been on campuses and the number of cases, it's been super, super small. And the Department of Public Health is prioritizing the teachers who are actually in person. And as far as the communities of color, we in the American Academy of Pediatrics care about all children. Many of our pediatricians work in communities of color. And I think the request that we're making is to try and figure it out. So these schools and school districts that have opened have It wasn't as if they opened on day one and knew exactly what to do. Implementing infection control measures to this level has not been done before. Everyone has to do it new, whether you're opening a school, opening a store, opening a restaurant. You have to kind of figure it out. And so it takes time, you know, several weeks. You try things, you do things. And so I think the frustration comes by seeing schools that aren't even trying. And it doesn't... Yeah. You mean that you have to open all of them, but focus on those communities of color, ask for help, look for best practices in places that have been able to do them successfully, and mm-hmm. adopt them. And we in the American Academy of Pediatrics are totally willing to help any school that wants to try to reopen.
Okay. We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Dr. Alice Kuo, Chief of Medicine Pediatrics at UCLA, member of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and LAUSD board member Jackie Goldberg. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Let me add one more.
Coming up, two women are coaching the Super Bowl game on Sunday. We're going to find out more about them next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. This Sunday Super Bowl game will be a historic moment for women in sports. For the first time ever, two women will be coaching. They are Maral Javadafar and Lori Locust. They're both part of the coaching staff for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who will take on the Kansas City Chiefs in Tampa this weekend. And here to talk about these women in the NFL and what it means for the league is Deandra Liu. She covers the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for Sports Illustrated. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, tell us a little bit more about these women, beginning with Maral Javadafar. What does she do for the team?
Yeah, so she is the assistant strength and conditioning coach. She has a physical therapy background, and her story is really special. She comes from parents who are immigrants and created a life for her, and she's been able to build this amazing career, and I think it makes it a little more special now going into the Super Bowl game because this is kind of the peak of her career.
Mm, right. And so what does it mean to be a conditioning coach? What does that entail?
Yeah, so it's kind of like she's a trainer for the team. And I think they have five assistant strength and conditioning coaches, and she's one of them.
And her colleague, Lori Locust, what does she do?
Yeah, so she's the assistant defensive line coach. And the part that's really special about Coach Lowe is she started playing football when she was 40. She had a completely different career. She worked in insurance for over 20 years and started playing football, decided she got hurt. She actually got injured because she started playing at the age of 40. She got injured pretty quickly and was on the sidelines and decided coaching was the way that she wanted to go. And from then it was history for her. And she left her job of over 20 years. And now, you know, she did coach. She had some internships. She was an intern for the Baltimore Ravens. She coached high school kids. She really started from the ground and worked her way up. And now she is about to coach in the Super Bowl.
Wow. So how are the guys on the team reacting to having these two female coaches?
What I love about the Buccaneers team is they're incredibly diverse. And they don't think anything of it. So there are two women coaches, but really what they're focused on is just getting better. Who's going to help them get better? Who's going to help them get to this point? And who's going to help them win the Super Bowl? So really, they don't think anything of it. And I've spoken with Coach Lowe a lot about this. And, you know, it's just a natural thing for them. They want to normalize women in football. And I think we are on that path.
Well, why do they want to normalize women in football?
Because there's so many women who who want to have this career. And this is really the first time, I would say, just in the past couple of years. You know, last year we had Katie Sowers coaching in the Super Bowl for the San Francisco 49ers. So this is still, it's still new, but we had six women coaching in the playoffs this year. So just like men get a chance to coach in the NFL, women also deserve, you know, the same opportunities as men. So, you know, I noticed kind of in the press conferences this week, I've been hearing so much, you know, you get a couple questions to ask these women and it's more about them being women than more about their coaching skills. So that's something that I think is really important going forward is we realize that they're coaches just like the male coaches, you know, they've worked so hard for this, just like the men.
Yeah. Well, do they have a different style than the men?
No, you know, I've asked Coach Lowe this. I did ask her, actually, I interviewed her at the beginning of the season. I asked her what her coaching style was, and it's in line with, you know, the other coaches. Everything that she does is in line with the other coaches. She is a coach. She's perfected her craft just like all the other coaches. And I think that's the most important part of this is it's significant that women are breaking into the coaching field. And this is, you know, the beginning of it. But it's also significant to remember that they're coaches just like the men.
Yeah. Well, so no head coaches, no women head coaches. Is that?
No women head coaches yet. I think we're at eight coaches in the NFL right now. Something really significant also is there is an effort by the NFL. They've created this pipeline of women. 50% are women of color. And it's very intentional the way that they're trying to make sure that women have an opportunity to coach in the NFL. And I hope through that pipeline, soon we will have a woman as a head coach.
Wow. And who might be that candidate? Is there anyone waiting in the wings for that?
I mean, this is the first year that we've really had, you know, a good amount of women coaching. So we're just going to have to see. I mean, if Coach Lowe, we'll see if she can win the Super Bowl. I would think that would be a pretty big step towards that goal. But, you know, it'll take a while. And just like everyone else, it's something that they'll have to work towards.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Deandra Liu. She covers the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for Sports Illustrated and writes a series called The Women of the NFL. Coming up, a silver lining to the pandemic, delicious Instagram pop-up restaurants.
It is a little messy. It's not like driving to a restaurant, going to a restaurant, sitting down and ordering from the menu. You have to put in a little bit of work, but she gives you all the information that she can, and you just have to keep checking in.
We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We've talked a lot about the devastating effects the pandemic has had on restaurants. But as with all things, there is a silver lining. With limited opportunities in professional kitchens these days, some enterprising chefs have turned their personal kitchens into pop-up takeout spots. They use Instagram mainly to promote their menus. So you can order jeweled Persian rice or a gorgeously decorated cake or even some meticulously curated banchan. It can be tricky, though. You have to be in the know to get an order in. Well, we're going to find out how to do that now with Tejal Rao. She's the California restaurant critic for the New York Times. She's based here in LA, and she wrote about the rise of these pop-ups. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, you are in the biz, as it were. So, of course, you have inside knowledge, but do the rest of us get this inside knowledge? How do we get in the know? How do we find out about these places?
Yeah, I mean, so they're not secret. They all have public-facing profiles on Instagram. It's just a matter of following them. And then from there, it can get a little bit chaotic because everyone's on a different schedule. They have different different days of the week when their new menu comes out. The pickup schedules are different for all of them. So it's a little unpredictable. It's a little chaotic. But if you follow them, then they're constantly kind of sending updates on what they're selling and when you can get it.
So you wrote in your story that you have like 50 calendar alerts set up for these menu drops on Instagram?
Yeah, there's a lot of places where I keep, you know, I keep missing them, or I already have a pickup that day, so I can't do it. So, you know, Instagram's not really built to support these kinds of businesses. It's really, especially with their recent updates last year, it's built more for shopping, you know, clothes, yeah, jewelry, that kind of stuff. It's not really made for restaurants or for pop-ups. So they have to kind of just make it work for themselves. So there's no other way to get an alert other than setting one up for yourself. So my calendar is like, check, you know, on a Thursday, it's, you know, check the menu, pay this guy, or, you know, it's very messy, but I do think it's worth it because I think some of the most exciting food in LA right now is coming from these, you know, home kitchens of restaurant cooks.
Okay, well, tell us about some of them, some of your favorites.
My number one favorite at the moment is it's Perilla, which is Jihee Kim's pop-up. And she's a chef who used to work at a bunch of fine dining restaurants in the Bay Area. And she used to work at Rustic Canyon here. And her family back in South Korea in Busan runs a restaurant. So she always dreamed about opening a little banchan shop. That's what she wanted to do, but she was working in, you know, American fine dining restaurants. And so now she goes to the farmer's market every week and she picks up whatever looks good, green beans, broccolini, Japanese yams, and makes all of these delicious dishes. One of my favorites is she makes this very delicate omelet that's rolled into a beautiful spiral with seaweed. Her green bean muchim is made with confit garlic and sesame seeds. It's not all, you know, super traditional Korean banchan, although she does offer some of those dishes. It's almost like California, you know, Los Angeles style banchan, mm-hmm, using whatever's growing here in season.
So you would have to find her on Instagram and then order it through her page there.
Yeah, exactly. And she'll, you know, it is a little messy. It's not like driving to a restaurant, going to a restaurant, sitting down and ordering from the menu. You have to put in a little bit of work, but she gives you all the information that she can, and you just have to keep checking in.
Okay, so Perilla, and it's spelled?
P-E-R-I-L-L-A.
And what else?
Another one I really love is called Side Pie, which is in Altadena. That is Kevin Hawkins' pizza place. And it was recently, you know, these pop-ups are kind of operating in a gray area. So it was recently asked to shut down by the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. But it's back. And it's great. So that's Side Pie, S-I-D-E-P-I-E, with these really light, thin crust pizzas that are delicious. Mm.
And this is basically, he cooks them in his backyard. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. He built a beautiful brick oven in his backyard, and there's a little gap in his fence so you can keep your distance when you come to pick up. They put the pizza boxes on a little shelf that's connected to the backyard fence, and you just take it.
Oh my gosh. I love that. I love that image. But why did the health department shut him down for a while?
Okay, so in this case, it's because a neighbor was complaining about the business. In most cases, you know, the health department is either kind of looking away or unaware of these businesses. They've been operating for a long time in LA. I mean, home cooks and professional cooks have been using social media, Instagram and Facebook, to sell food this way for a really long time, kind of under the radar, directly to their community. So it's not new. But I think as the restaurant industry has been sort of decimated, the workforce that powers all of these tiny food businesses has just suddenly expanded, and there's more than can be regulated.
Well, is that something that we should worry about as consumers?
I mean, yeah, having food businesses that are unregulated is not ideal. But, you know, I'm a former restaurant cook, and I trust cooks who are being completely transparent about their workspaces, about their practices, about where their ingredients come from. It's not ideal. The whole situation is not ideal, but I trust them and I'm drawn to their work. And I think in most cases, they are maintaining their restaurant standards as much as possible.
Okay, so let's talk about a dessert place, because we do need some dessert.
There are so many pastry chefs who are using Instagram to sell their cakes and pastries and sweets. And they've actually been doing this for a long time because pastry chefs were some of the first restaurant positions to be cut when staffs were being cut during the pandemic and even before that. One of my favorites is Sasha Pilijian, who I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She used to be a pastry chef at Squirrel, and she sells weekly pastry boxes where you just pay $20 and it's whatever Sasha has baked that day. You know, a sticky bun, a cookie, a Danish, or you can do special orders of cakes, and her cakes are absolutely stunning. I got a citrus cake recently covered with candied fruit, and inside the layers there was a coriander lime curd. Just absolutely beautiful.
Oh my gosh, that sounds incredible. And so where would you find Sasha?
Sasha is on Instagram. Her handle is sashimi1.
Sashimi1.
Yes.
But we're not getting sashimi from her. We're getting cake.
Exactly. And the name of her bakery is May Provisions.
May Provisions. Well, it's really encouraging to see so much ingenuity and creativity. What do you think is going to happen with all these home cooks once the pandemic is over and restaurants open back up?
I mean, it's hard right now for me to even imagine what that's going to look like. You know, the future of the restaurant industry is so uncertain right now. So for now, I think this could be a really great path for a lot of cooks who are trying to figure out what to do in the meantime.
Is it sustainable for them? Can they make a living doing this?
Apparently, you know, Kevin Hawken, who I mentioned earlier, who runs Side Pie in Altadena, he told me this sort of bootleg pizza operation is somehow covering the costs of his coffee shop. So I think people can make it work because their teams are really small. They don't have the overhead costs of rent. But I don't think it's ideal.
Yeah. Seems like a lot of work. And there's like usually a one-man band doing it.
Yeah. And then there's limitations on their expansion. You know, ideally, they would be selling food a few days a week to really make it financially viable. But home kitchens aren't really equipped for that. You know, a normal size refrigerator doesn't hold what you need for a restaurant-like operation. So there's all kinds of limitations that might make that growth impossible.
So get it while you can. Tejal, thank you so much. This has been really interesting, really fun conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Tejal Rao is California restaurant critic for the New York Times. Coming up, where to get really good chocolate for Valentine's Day. Evan Kleiman is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
It's February, which means one thing, at least when it comes to food, and that is chocolate. A lame Valentine's Day cliche? Yes, it is. But do we accept any and all reasons to talk about chocolate? Yes, we do. And frankly, after this year we've all had, is it really such a bad thing to indulge in our love for chocolate? Here with me is Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food, and she is here to tell us where to get our chocolate fix. Hi.
Hi. And first of all, I would like to say, you know, chocolate has all those antioxidants. So I think that, you know, all of us can use that kind of boost to our immune systems.
Yeah. Okay. Lots of other food has antioxidants too. But anyway,
I think of chocolate more like a food.
You do?
Yeah, if you're talking about just chocolate, like a bar of chocolate. Right. You know, once you get into candy and pastry, yeah, then it gets a little more complicated. But if you're just talking about chocolate, I think it's necessary.
Do you think it's that we can get good chocolate here? Is this a good chocolate town, LA?
I think that one of the great benefits of living in a giant megalopolis is that there are so many creative people making delicious things. And yes, we are a little hotbed of chocolate making in the United States.
Can you just walk me through what it takes to make chocolate? Like, if you want to make a chocolate bar, do you have to actually make the chocolate, or do you buy kind of raw chocolate and turn it into a chocolate bar?
Well, people do both. So quite a few chocolatiers and confectioners who are more focused on the creative addition of flavor and texture in terms of inclusions, you know, adding things, will often start with a chocolate that's already made. But over the last, I'd say, 8 years or so, maybe even 10, there's this new phrase that many of us have come to know. It's called bean to bar. And these are people who have been interested in starting farther back along the chain of creating chocolates. They don't just want to take chocolate that's already made, remelt and temper it, and add different things or make it pretty in terms of making bonbons, which is an amazing business. And many people are doing that deliciously here in LA. They're really, really committed to getting to know the people who actually grow cacao. So they're people who are more interested in the agriculture of the chocolate, getting to make direct contact with farmers, and then taking those cacao beans, the actual beans that come out of those giant pods, and turning those into chocolate and then creating a great bar from that. So that is a very different enterprise than what a chocolatier does.
And where would you find a good example of that, a bean to bar chocolate bar?
I'm highlighting three makers today. One is Carr Artisan Chocolate. Harris Carr, he's a bean to bar maker in Pasadena. What I love about his bars is he really explores milk and white chocolates, which is often a rarity amongst bean to bar makers, many of whom are in thrall with the darkest chocolate they can possibly make. So he also makes darker chocolate, but his bars run the gamut. They're really delicious.
Wait a minute. I thought white chocolate was a myth. Was made up.
No,
it is.
No, it's not true. No, yes, it's a thing. Well, it's cocoa butter and sugar, and then some chocolate solids. If you want to mix some in, what's fun for these people who are bean to bar makers is part of the process of making the chocolate from the beans. Is this separation you get from the different parts. You get the liquor, you get the butter. And so they can dial in what exactly they want to make from the different constituent parts.
I see. And the white chocolate is the butter without the liquor?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. And a lot of people, what they're doing with this, they're playing with caramelizing it, which adds this completely different flavor and color to it. And boy, is that good.
Yum. So like a nutty taste.
More like a caramelized taste. And then you have that incredible meltability, which is what white chocolate always has. It has a lower melting point.
Okay, so that's Carr Artisan.
That's Carr Artisan Chocolate. Then we have Nicole Trutanik, whose bar au chocolat is really extraordinary. What began as a passion for her became a study of agriculture, chemistry, history, politics, culture, art, and the physiology of taste. Her focus is very minimalist. She focuses on how the inherent bitterness of the cacao can be brought into beautiful balance with just the right amount of sugar. So she's really a purist. She also makes beautiful art from chocolate, and her work is quite spectacular.
And where would you get that?
All these places are available. I mean, they all have shops in LA, but mm-hmm. they're available online. They all have okay. online presence.
Okay.
A Bar au Chocolat.
Bar au Chocolat.
Then you have Choco Vivo, who is Patricia Tsai. She's another bean to bar maker. She moved from behind a computer where she crunched numbers to creating a Mexican style stone ground chocolate. So Mexican chocolate is very different from a Swiss-based chocolate, which is known for its absolute smoothness. It goes through this process called conching, in which the cocoa liqueur is just rolled over itself over and over and over again until the crystalline structure of it changes, and you get that really smooth texture of chocolate. Mexican chocolate is just stone ground, and so it has this inherent rusticity that a lot of people are drawn to. Often it's used as a drinking chocolate. She actually has a drinking chocolate kit, which is adorable, and it includes a very beautiful mug to drink it out of, but you get everything you need to make yourself fantastic Mexican drinking chocolate at home.
Mm, which is like hot chocolate, but with a kick.
Exactly. But she also makes bars. So one thing about Patricia is that she uses cocoa from one farmer in Tabasco, Mexico. She met this man. He ended up mentoring her. They have a very close relationship. She said he's almost like a father to her. And then she also has created a line of skincare products based on the cocoa butter that is a byproduct of her chocolate making.
Wow. So you can eat it and then slather it all over your skin.
Exactly. So those are the bean to bar makers.
Okay. And we're going to have links on
our website.
Oh, yes. We
have all the information on the website. Okay. Next, we go to the chocolatiers. You know, people who are just crazy creative. They love to make shapes. So bonbons are anything that's like a one or two bite. Little confection. The first is Mila Chocolates, which is Christine and Gogtug Sarios. They source mostly from the Dominican Republic, Peru, and Venezuela. She is the maker and he is the designer. Their molds of their bonbons are really unusual in that they're so architectural. So they're not so frou-frou pretty that a lot of chocolates are, but they're stunning. I'm really drawn to her dragées, which are these chocolate-enrobed almonds. They're craveable.
Maybe a step up from the Trader Joe's ones.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm not slighting those. Those are good, but...
Oh, no, those are great. But, you know, when you have a person whose passion is this and they care about sourcing, it's like choosing to go to the farmer's market or not. You know, so it's a different experience.
Also more expensive.
Yes, more expensive. But for Valentine's, you know, a little
Treat
splurge.
Yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. So Rose Noir Chocolates is another chocolatier. Lindsay Newman formerly worked at SLS. So this is her, quote, pivot. She created this new line of chocolate called Rose Noir. And she makes exquisite bonbons. They're so pretty. She sells at farmers markets in the high desert, which is where she lives, and online. If you want to get like a beautiful red or pink box filled with fabulously adorable, beautiful things, this is where you go.
Thank you. I would love that. Thank you, Evan.
And, you know, to me, Valentine's, especially in times of COVID, it's really the time to explore our inner Colette and lay in bed with a box of something on our tummies and just either break off a piece of that bean to bar chocolate or pop a bonbon in your mouth.
Or several.
Yes.
Or the whole box. Let's
repeat. Eat and repeat.
Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. And as she said, we will have links to all of the chocolatiers on our website. Okay, so much for the diet. That has been blown. Thank you very much, Evan. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast. Listen whenever or wherever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a delicious rest of your day. I'll see you tomorrow.